Right. Okay. I'm going to read some extracts from the second chapter of my book, Out of a Clear Sky. And I think there are a number of you here who were in my year at Birkbeck and in my class. And I think some of you may recognise some of this chapter. I thought it'd be interesting for you to see what had changed and what had not changed. So just to give, for the rest of you who haven't had that privilege, or whatever the opposite privilege is. I'm a writer, I work with words. This is the opening chapter of the book, then sets the scene, and it then jumps back 6 months into the past to New Year's Day, which is when, of course, all but good bird watchers start their lists. With the cool grey of a January dawn, details emerge slowly out of the murk. I was crouched on the shingle bank, watching a group of waders following the ebbing tide, probing with their beaks through the mud for invertebrates. Along the smaller waders, a bigger bird, a godwit, was working its way through the mud channels. I had just set up the scope and was trying to get the bird in it to check the colour of the tail and the streaking on the back. Most of the birds were oblivious to my presence, moving busily back and forth on the important business of feeding. But the godwit seemed to be aware of it was being watched, and every time I had it nicely in the centre of my lens, it would duck behind a hummock of seaweed or into a deeper channel, where it would disappear for a few seconds and then reappear at the worst possible angle. Finally, it hopped up onto a clump and stood showing nicely as I fumbled with stiffened fingers to get it into focus. The slanting sun broke through the cloud, and for a few seconds, each feather was sharply picked out in its light. The bird was preening, and I could see the busy movements of its beak through the plumage, the inward-turned concentration of the eye. We were joined together, just for a moment, in the curious one-sided intimacy of the telescope. But then something spooked the whole flock of them, and first the godwit, and then every other bird in the harbour rose with a cacophony of alarm calls. Most of them circled once, calling and settled, but the godwit was gone. I turned to look at the source of disturbance, hoping it was someone just passing through, a dog walker, someone I could ignore. But this was another birder, grinning as though he knew me, dressed in a bright turquoise anorak and a fleece bobble hat that seemed to have been designed to be seen from a helicopter in a blizzard. He was armed with his set of new-looking binoculars, Leicas, 8x42s, and he had a Swarovski scope slung over his shoulder. My heart sank. I was in no mood to be sociable. "Anything interesting?" he asked. "There might have been." I tried to keep the irritation out of my voice. "What?" "Godwit." "Bar-tailed," he said confidently. "No, black. I could see the tail as you flushed it up." He ignored my sarcasm. "The Hidebook's got an entry for a bar-tailed." I suppressed the urge to point out that Hidebooks weren't infallible, and besides, birds had a tendency to move around. Instead, I looked blankly at him and hoped he would go away. No such luck. "Where is it?" He raised his binoculars, started scanning the horizon. "It flew away." This time, I hadn't quite managed to keep the edge out of my voice. He looked at me, feigning hurt. "Ooh, a bit hungover, are we?" I didn't respond immediately. There was something familiar about him that had been nagging at me throughout our exchange, and now I had managed to place him. He'd shown up on a guided visit the bird group had taken to a sewage works the summer before. He can't have had the scope then, because he kept borrowing mine. But I remember the way he'd shown off the brand new Leicas, hovering anxiously behind them as they were passed from hand to hand. £800, he had said when they had been returned, and he hefted them in one hand as he spoke, as though their quality was something that could be weighed. I remember too the smirks behind his back, because everything he did and said betrayed his ignorance, and the expensive binoculars didn't prevent him from looking half the time at the wrong bird and misidentifying everything and finally almost losing his footing and having to be hauled back from the brink of a settling pond. He'd latched onto me in the end, when the teasing from the others became too audible to be ignored, and I had tolerated him then, encouraged him even. Irritating as he was, his chatter masked the fact that Gareth and I weren't really speaking, and hadn't been for weeks. It only served to deepen Gareth's mood, but I didn't care. Someone, anyone to talk to, someone to pay me a bit of attention, was better than the lengthening silence between us. And maybe I thought it might pique Gareth's interest a bit. So I had taken the time to show this guy where to look for the rarer gulls, how to tell them apart, let him use my scope, but Gareth ignored me anyway. Walked on without speaking, shutting me out. I softened. Well, he was probably right. I was hungover. Any other year, I would have been tucked up in bed early on New Year's Eve, ready for an early start. Our big celebration for New Year Day was the day itself. and the chance to kick off the year list together with as many birds as we could, making every bird suddenly fresh and new, something exciting. But that was then, when there was an us. Now Gareth would be birding somewhere else, with someone else, if he could drag Essex Girl out with him. And my sister, guilty at abandoning me over Christmas, had insisted I'd spend the night with her friends. I'd worn a social mask all evening, uncomfortable with the effort. Xana had treated me with the careful handling you'd give to recently mended china. Her friends had been polite, friendly, ultimately remote. I'd left as soon as I decently could and walked home, back through the damp alien London streets. But the late night had taken its toll on my mood. I'd had my fill of semi-strangers. Still, there was no need to be rude. I had been a new birder once, and probably just as annoying. I mustered the closest I could manage to a smile. Maybe a bit hungover, I offered, and he grinned. While we'd been talking, a few more waders had flown in, and the rest were feeding again, as though they had never been disturbed. Out the corner of my eye, I could see the constant bustle of the birds as they probed for food, side by side in companionable silence. So many little sewing machines stitching through the mud. I was itching to get back to them, watching them, in peace and on my own. "Anything else?" he asked. "Cattle egret over on the big shingle bank," I lied. "Cool," he trotted off, and I was alone at last. So she encounters him again, and he's even more subserviently friendly, but she finally shakes him off and heads off to do some last bird watching. Just finish this passage and should give you some of the feel of the book. So she just left him in a cafe. The cold air hit me as I turned up the street towards my car. All that was waiting for me in London was an afternoon spent rattling around the confines of my sister's flat until I could decently leave and go back to the unwelcome prospect of the empty house. Delaying the moment, I stopped off at the Pagan Reserve, checked out the ferry pool hide for some of the freshwater ducks, and then strolled along the banks of the silted-up harbour. Sitting on the sheltered bench was an old couple who must have been in their 70s. Both had ancient binoculars around their necks, and they were dickering gently away about who had misidentified what bird sometime back in 1957. They both smiled vaguely at me as I passed, and the man, seeing my own binoculars, suddenly said, "Nice kingfisher up by the cut, probably still there. Fishing it was," before he turned and resumed their running argument. I could believe that it was one that had been running on and off for the last 40-odd years. There'd been a time when I thought Gareth and I would end up like that, still birding for as long as we could totter. Leaning over the parapet of the bridge, I looked up the cut and lingered there, half hopeful, half just waiting, to see if the kingfisher would appear. The river banks were a tangle of dead stems. The only movement came from the weed that flowed in the water, waving in the current. As I waited and watched, I became one more still thing in a world of dull greens and greys and browns, and the birds which had fled at my approach began to re-emerge. It was a drear winter's day, really, raw and drizzling, but to the birds, acutely tuned to the lengthening of the light, the year had already turned and spring was on its way. I could hear a great tit calling, then a chaffinch, then the persistent territorial chucking of a wren. The only human sound was that of the couple's voices, carried to me on the wind in bursts. Nothing I could make out, just a tone of voice, equal parts affection and exasperation. I'd almost given up on the kingfisher when a flash passed under the bridge and shot straight to the vegetation on the riverside. I saw nothing but a glint of blue, and it took another minute of close searching with binoculars before I found the bird again. It was perched, swaying on a dead stick, staring down into the murk of the water. Even in the dull light it glistened, blue and turquoise and coral, incongruous among the drab fretwork of the bare branches. The kingfisher was the first bird I can really remember seeing, shown to me by my father. Not the common kingfisher, the one we see in England, but one of the African ones. I have never been able to work out exactly which species of kingfisher it was that my father and I watched through the Land Rover window. Probably a pygmy or a malachite. I don't recall much else about the day, or why we were out driving alone together with me sitting in the prize front seat. Maybe my mother was ill that day. Maybe she was off somewhere with Xana. Maybe it was some special treat I'd earned. I would have been about 8. My head filled with animals, not birds. I remember only my father stopping the car abruptly and backing up the dirt road, the engine whining with the effort, until we were level with a small tangled stream choked with debris. "Look, Manda, there, on the reed." I looked, willing to do anything my father asked. Held my breath in silence at his hushed tone. And when I saw it, everything else faded. The bird sat impervious, jeweled in turquoise and blue feathers. It was stilled and attentive, its whole being focused down towards some point in the muddy water beneath it. What fish could be small enough to be caught by this tiny toy? For a minute it hung motionless from the reed and then took off and seemed to hover over that spot in the water before plunging downwards. It returned briefly with a minnow squirming in its beak and then was gone, as though the whole scene had been something my father had conjured up for me and then dispelled. I turned to ask him what we'd seen, but he was still staring at the space where the bird had been, as though patient watching could call it back. I let the words die, and the spell held us both in silence until we regained home. I'd rushed to boast about it to Zanna, that I'd seen a bird that Dad had pointed out to me, a bird catching a fish. I tried to describe it, couldn't find the words, my arms windmilling with frustration, Zanna disbelieving. Finally, I appealed to my father, but he was gone, the door to the study shutting behind him with a click. The English kingfisher I was watching now was bigger and less magical than my remembered bird, but it too could hover for a moment of suspended time as it chose its point to strike. It seemed to barely disturb the water, and then it was back on its branch, a fish held firmly in its dagger beak. I saw now, as I had been too mesmerised to see then, the tearing cruelty in the way it mastered its struggling prey, surrounded by the flashing drops of water. Fish and bird both glittered for a second against the drab of the bank, and then were gone. On my way back to the car, I passed the couple again, gave them the thumbs up. "See it, did you?" They both smiled, the same smile, grown alike together. I smiled back, feeling very much alone, walked back to the car in the eye-watering wind. As I turned the corner, the loneliness dissolved into irritation. There David was again, in the car park, leaning against my car. This time he seemed lost in a reverie, gazing into space. I was surprised he could be so still. His hands hung down by his sides as though in readiness for something. Without the vacant grin, his face was drawn and wary. Only when we turned and he saw me did the animation return. "We meet again." I hadn't the energy to humour him this time, to do anything but stand and wait for him to move so I could get away. "Leaving already?" he asked. "When you stop using my car as a resting place, yes?" He sprang aside, motioned me in, bowed clownishly as I started to drive away. I dismissed the whole encounter from my mind, thinking of the road ahead, the long drive back to town. But I couldn't quite shape off the lingering image that I had of the capering figure with the grinning face watching me as I drove away.